My idea is that we, through being matter, which is the yearning for transformation and contact, we inevitably experience this material reality as meaningful and as full of feeling. That's my link. That's my attempt to pull these things together. And then I go out into nature and I'm searching for instances and for stories and narratives which show this.
Biologist and philosopher Andreas Weber reframes ecology as a tender practice of forging relationships, of yearning for connections, and of expressing these desires through our bodies. Being alive is an erotic process, constantly transforming the self through contact with others. We discuss his book, Matter and Desire, An Erotic Ecology. It's time for Progressive Spirit. Stick around. You're listening to the podcast version of Progressive Spirit. If you enjoy the show, please go to iTunes, Stitcher, Google Play, Podomatic, TuneIn, or whatever podcast app you use to listen and give Progressive Spirit 5 stars, won't you? Contact me through progressivespirit.net with your thoughts and ideas about the show, and be sure to share this podcast on your social media. Follow on Facebook and Twitter. The website, again, is progressivespirit.net. For the Pacifica Radio Network, PRX, Public Radio Exchange, and from the studios of KBOO in Portland, Oregon, this is Progressive Spirit, progressivespirit.net. I'm John Schock.
One thing we know about life is that if it is full life, full aliveness, it is about joy. It is joyful. It is the celebration of connection, or it is the feast of individuality through others. And that's something, to my eyes, that we always receive through other beings in ecosystems, in the biosphere. So in a traditional way of using the language, you would say this is what we experience in nature. It's the joy of being self in connection. And that's very contagious. That's so contagious that we always want to go there, and we see these shining autumn leaves, or we see the spring blossoms. We will see the spring blossoms next year, and then we'll feel that we are also spring blossoms opening for a connection, and that's joyful. So there's a basic happiness about being a part of this world in connection. And I would say any suffering and any pain, which, as we know, there's a lot of that in this world, it has to do with an obstruction of the joy of being in connection.
Andreas Weber is a Berlin-based philosopher, biologist, and writer. He holds degrees in marine biology and cultural studies. His books in English include Enlivenment Towards a Fundamental Shift in the Concepts of Nature, Culture and Politics, The Biology of Wonder, Aliveness, Feeling, and the Metamorphosis of Science, and Biopoetics Towards an Existential Ecology. Weber regularly contributes to major newspapers and magazines such as National Geographic, and he's won a number of awards for his writing. His latest book and our subject today is Matter and Desire, An Erotic Ecology. And he's with me via Skype from Berlin, where he teaches philosophy. Welcome, Andreas Weber, to Progressive Spirit.
Hi, John. Good evening.
Well, tell me about this exciting book, Matter and Desire, An Erotic Ecology. How did it come to be?
It has many sources, maybe it's important to stress that one of the sources is my personal everyday experience of a being in the world with flesh and skin and with feelings and desires and with this particular longing to be in touch with other particularly non-human beings. So I actually, for the whole of my writing career, I'm searching to understand Why do I have this desire to be in touch with other plants and animals and the air around me and the earth with its gravity? And the book is an attempt to understand that as a process of mutual erotic attraction, mediated by bodies, by my skin, by matter. And in the course of doing this, which is very much a narrative in very many places of the book, so I tell stories, I tell my own story, I talk about others and other beings, so it's nature writing. And in the course of doing this, I'm trying to understand reality as not as something neutral with objects separated from subjects, but as a huge, complex and incomplete emotional process of interchange and relationship and transformation. So I try to get the world of bodies from the inside, as I am a body, but I am also an inside, an inwardness, a feeling. That's the starting point, or that's my endeavor of the whole thing.
And in a sense, it is a response in part to more what we might say, what a mechanistic understanding of science as we inherited it from, say, the 16th century and forward, as with subject versus object and the material dead world that we study via scientific method. So, for example, you are a scientist, you're a biologist, and you're also a writer. Are you seeing kind of a change in the way that that science is happening? Are we becoming more, as you might say, erotic in terms of our understanding our world in which we live?
Yeah, absolutely. I'm seeing ourselves in a time of change. It's a huge tide shift at the moment, and some people call this the Anthropocene, or others would say it's a breakdown in the dualism of science, or still others would say that that in the humanities, so if you write a book, a philosophical book about humans and nature, you're already in the humanities. In the humanities, the fashion of seeing the world in terms of a construction of human minds or of language systems starts to become a little bit outdated. So in a way, we science itself and the many flavors of science are changing from a very long-term way of seeing things into something which we don't know yet. But it's a major shift which is happening at the moment, and the major shift goes always in the direction of getting our hands dirty, of not being able to separate things and feelings or matter and mind. So we start to understand that any thinking process means to move matter and comes about by matter. So it's not detachable. Matter matters also for philosophers and semioticians, and on the other hand, we see that everything material creates a meaning in this world and creates an inwardness. So we are actually on a trajectory where science discovers that humans are not that separated from the remainder of the world, which is to my eyes, it's an amazing pull to something much more healthy and much more sane, and something desperately needed, actually.
I think we're seeing kind of a change in language, rather than say, I'm going out to discover nature, those kinds of things, that really we're recognizing, of course, that how could we be anything but nature? And it begins within.
Absolutely. And I mean, I have ceased to use the word nature in terms of talking about the other beings which are non-human, because I basically see this is a massive form of othering, or you could even say it's speciesism. It's excluding others from something we have, or it's excluding ourselves from something they have. So we have a if we do this, we create a basic rift. And I know that many, I did this until not that much time ago, actually. I talked about nature with this yearning of something which is somehow not impacted by the destruction humans bring about. So nature also has this romantic ringing to it. But on the other hand, it means that we always, if we keep nature there on the other side, we always construct something ideal, which then is kind of untouchable to us. And to me, it's a kind of everyday exercise, not to talk about nature, but to talk about other beings or other subjects or fellow beings or fellow subjects. And I'm actually just now reading the latest book of Timothy Morton, the philosopher Tim Morton, which the title is Humankind. And he does this coming from the very, let's say, very stylish, very leftish, very gender Marxist humanities. And he finds, he talks about a network of symbiosis and a yearning for symbiosis, which includes everything from atoms up to ideas. And I see this as a much more realistic way of coping with our reality, because it does away with this shift, which we always have carried inside ourselves and which we could never really explain and which has caused so many suffering. I mean, suffering on the scale of somebody going to the doctor and the doctor prescribing pills against basically a feeling, let's say antidepressants against feeling low. So you are treated like a machine and you're somehow left there with this fissure in yourself. Or on the other hand, like if you treat the environment like just something which is out there, you destroy it. So we realize we can't go on with this. And so in a way, I'm totally excited about the time we're in, because it finally on many fronts, in many places, in many through many minds, we are doing away with these unhealthy and toxic separations. But on the other hand, we are in a time which still works with these separations. If you look at the mainstream happenings, like mainstream economy or mainstream politics or mainstream natural science, it's still working according to the old scheme. So we need to be quick, actually, and push forward our new thinking.
Yes, Andreas Weber, my guest, author of Matter and Desire, An Erotic Ecology. Can you talk a little bit about the selection of words for your title? Erotic, desire, there's a sensual, sexual quality to that. Did you mean to invoke that in the title of your work?
Well, I wasn't against invoking this a little bit. And I mean, every author is always thinking, what is the best-selling title ever? But I mean, it's broader. So it's right. It's more that I include human sexuality in this huge fascination of bodies by one another. And when I say bodies, I mean already atoms, which in a way yearn to get into contact with another. If you look at the water molecule, it's composed of two hydrogen atoms and one oxygen atom. And in a way, if you put them together under the right circumstances, they bond. They have this tendency to bond. And if we look at the history of the cosmos, you can only explain it by the, let's say, curiosity or the yearning, the tendency, the inbuilt drive of bits of reality, of material bits of reality, or of structures and processes mediated by energy, of always encountering other. And by always encountering others, somehow changing themselves and other and giving birth to something new. So to my eyes, this is it's that large when I'm talking about eros. So there's a fundamental, let's say, you could call it tendency, but I like to talk about desire, because because I am also part of this cosmos, and I know desire from the inside, and I'm a body, and I feel desire to go on, to keep being alive, to prosper, to connect with others, to breathe, to drink, to eat, whatever. And so in a way, I'm thinking that we should, if we do away with the borders between these two sides of the rift, which are matter and mind, if we do away with them, if we accept that we are basically matter, which is at the same time an experience of inwardness, then we can also argue from the standpoint of ourselves. We are a feature of reality, and we know what reality is about because we are this reality. And being this reality, we know that we are desireful of connection, not only of sexual connection. That's an important part, but it's only a part. And connection is much broader than this. But we can feel ourselves as being matter, yearning for connection. And so we can understand the unfolding cosmos from our personal standpoint, which when I allowed myself to think this thought, I just found amazing. I was just thinking, wow, so I can be totally on the inside, and I can feel myself as part of the world, which is even able to have an idea of itself as world. So I was really consoled by that thought. And I think it's good to be led back into the world, which in so many ways we have left by our human way of excluding us in this ivory tower of being better or being different. And coming back to your answer, so it's in a way it's a very first person approach to say this world is about yearning to be and to be in connection, and I know this because I am this world. And on the other hand, we can see if we look at what happens in physics, in chemistry, in biology, we can see that everything is always trying to forge new connections, and that's a massive erotic happening. And I think it's we need this in natural sciences, some vector, some flavor of feeling. That's what is missing, basically.
Well, we've had a long philosophical history, really, of mind over matter, or we might say mind above matter, or the human being as kind of the apex of creation, that kind of theological and philosophical thing that we're recognizing. I think now with modern science, biology and evolution, that obviously we are matter. You talk about this experience, the inner experience of aliveness. Can you say more about that?
Yeah, that's actually what I just would like to add to your comment to what I said about my my self-consciousness of talking about myself as matter, which is at the same time inwardness. Uh-huh. Because in the what happened was that in the, let's say, in Christian culture, in Christian Occidental culture, we had this idea which you refer to of mind over matter, because ultimately it was mind who ruled the world or created the world, and this shifted with modern science, and then it was matter over mind. So then it was the laws of matter can explain the caprices of the mind. So that was just the other way around. And that was when the two domains really started to lose contact with one another. So there were these guys in the humanities who still had the idea that it's basically about mind, or then they called it language, or they called it structure, or they called it economies of discourse, or whatever, or construction of dispositions. But on the other hand, I'd say the materially dominating version, and you refer to evolutionary theory, or to basic findings in physics, was more or less doing without mind. That was just a kind of artifact or an epiphenomenon, which which we actually didn't really need. So modern brain research was about, like, why do we need a feeling of qualities when we are basically biological machines? And what I am trying to do is to find a way somewhere between these extremes. So just to find a middle way, which is reconciling fully being matter by fully being experience or fully being inwardness. And to my eyes, that's the door which is being opened by biological research. And that's just the bit we are missing. So if we have only the two extremes on both sides, we can't really, there's always the vacuum in the middle. My idea is that we, through being matter, which is the yearning for transformation and contact, we inevitably experience this material reality as meaningful and as full of feeling. That's my link. That's my attempt to pull these things together. And then I go out into nature and I'm searching for instances and for stories and narratives which show this.
And so that inner experience of aliveness, is that feeling of awe? Is it that feeling of discovery? Is it the amazement of being alive itself? Is it kind of reminding ourselves that we exist?
Well, I'd say that in a way it's like concentrating on our feeling of being alive. It amounts to be this kind of deep, even mystical experience of, oh wow, I am really a center of concern in this world which truly belongs to me. This is the focus or the point where this culminates. But when I'm talking about aliveness as as a category of experience and also of thinking, I'm more talking about a very everyday experience, actually, which is the same one, but in a way not that much conscious and not that elaborated and not that concentrated into a really special experience. Aliveness means actually to feel myself as a vulnerable body with a desire to carry on among a world which also consists of vulnerable bodies. So it means to be matter, and on the other hand to be a feeling center to which everything which happens means something, because I'm vulnerable. I can ultimately die. I ultimately will die. And to my eyes, the condition of aliveness is something which is shared by every living being, every cell, actually. And because it's shared, and because it's always about desiring to go on to exist versus the danger or the threat, or the fate of dying, it is always meaningful. Living beings always have meaningful experiences because they are no machines. They are not constructed by somebody and then they execute orders. They always are a concern. The concern of getting on in a meaningful way, which would change the perspective totally, with the perspective we have on our biosphere, on the reality.
Say a little bit more about one of your chapters is called Death, and there's a paragraph here under the heading "Living Means Learning to Die." You write, yeah, the universe is not purely gentle; it's just as deadly as it is gentle, yeah, and it can, yeah, only be gentle because it is deadly, and it can only be, yeah, gentle insofar as its gentleness constantly puts up a fight against death. And this is the message of erotic ecology, one that sets it against Darwinism. Can you go ahead and explain that a little bit more? What do you mean by learning? Living means learning to die.
Yeah, and on first hand, it might seem a bit strange and even a bit, let's say, irritating. But on the other hand, we need to see that to be alive is not a state which you get and then it's there and then it might be over at some point. It's a constant creation of something which is functioning, but which in every moment starts already to decay. So what a cell is doing is always constructing itself. So it's not a thing. It's not a clockwork. It's not a computer. But it's a it's a tendency to build up oneself, and this tendency to build up oneself means that every living being always needs to incorporate stuff and matter from the outside and needs to give away something from itself. That's a scientist would call this metabolism. But from a matter as desire standpoint, we can see that to live means to continuously be challenged by the incorporation of otherness, of other matter, of relations to others, of others as meaningful for my own existence. So there's no substantial essence which just functions if it's not disturbed. But life is rather a continuous disturbance, underlying a continuous desire for closeness. So death, in a way, is built into life as one of its sides. It's the side of continuous change, of continuous reaching out to other, which then challenges self. And to my eyes, we shouldn't talk about death in opposition to life, but we should talk about life, including death and birth, which are always one side of the other. Every death is a birth. Every death of my own cells, in the sense that they set free their components in breathing out, means that there are taken up new components by eating, and which then replenish me as a body. And to my eyes, this is something our civilization and our scientific culture has very much pushed away in this epic search for immortality, which is so deeply characteristic of our culture and which has been so deeply characteristic of our culture, maybe from Greek times, from Plato, from Aristotle on. And so we tend to, or let's say scientists, philosophers, tend to exclude death from a positive definition of what is a viable functioning entity in the world. And to my eyes, it's wrong. We should see that that decay, that deconstruction, decomposition is part of what is happening in a living process. And to my eyes, you can prove this very well if you look at the basic biochemistry. And the interesting thing is that this absolutely perfectly dovetails which what we know about personal development. We all know that in order to be true to your own unfolding, you need to die certain deaths in the sense of clinging to a lifestyle that you know you don't really need anymore, because you need to do something which is about change, and which means to do away with certain things, or you need to die in terms of facing a challenge which is absolutely necessary but which terrifies you, or you need to die because you need to leave a relationship is not nourishing you and still it's holding you, so it's very difficult to do this. All these are, and everybody I think knows what I'm talking about, all these deaths are necessary in order to grant ongoing connection. We know this from personal life, and But it's not only in personal human development. It's also in material, let's say, cosmic development. All this is always about getting into contact and leaving the old shape in favor of a new shape. And so it's always about transformation. And only because there's so much dying, life is always so much rejuvenating. And that's an aspect which, let's say, mainstream science has not really taken up. But that's an aspect, I think, which shows very much that material aspects always have existential aspects or inwardness aspects. And they can mutually enlighten one another.
I'm John Schack. This is Progressive Spirit. I'm speaking with Andreas Weber. He's the author of Matter and Desire, An Erotic Ecology. More to come. Stay with us. Progressive Spirit is produced every week. It couldn't happen without the financial support of my congregation, Southminster Presbyterian Church in Beaverton, Oregon. Southminster's website is www.southmin.org. Progressive Spirit is produced in the studios of KBOO in Portland, Oregon, for the Pacifica Radio Network, and PRX, the Public Radio Exchange, as well as podcast. Show KBOO some love, won't you? KBOO.fm, and click donate. I'm speaking with Andreas Weber. He's the author of Matter and Desire, An Erotic Ecology. Weber proposes a new approach, the development of a poetic ecology, which intimately attaches our species to every being and underpins the entire range of human experience. He argues that feelings and emotions, far from being superfluous to the study of organisms, are the very foundation of life. This is Progressive Spirit. I'm John Schock. You know, we talked about immortality, and I've often thought many religions, of course, Christianity I'm thinking of, but others too, Islam, thinking that that's really the goal and the ideal is somehow living beyond, transcending one's own individual death. And that certainly has led to, I would say, in some respects, a devaluation, certainly, of the life that is real and right before us and within and between us. And what I get from reading your book is recognizing that meaning isn't in the, I don't know if that you would use this word, but supernatural, the outside the realm, but it's in the relationships of everything that is not only other people, but all beyond human beings as well, that the meaning is in that relationship, not in the entity. Is that?
Yeah, well, absolutely. Absolutely. And just to add some more explanations to that, I'd say that the supernatural is inside the natural. It's not beyond the natural.
Yeah. All right.
It's not beyond the natural, but it's inside the natural. So I'd even say that the one most important point to see is that that all is one, and we are within or part of this oneness, which still, for some reason, differentiates and yields separation, and this is the arena where we have to understand that in order to experience this oneness, we need to experience and to work on separation. So that's my take on supernatural is within the natural. I think it is all here and it is within us already. And it depends on our way of seeing and doing things. It's not somewhere there, and it's not, let's say, beyond our embodied lives in flesh and blood together, with all the yearning other beings in this world. That's very important to me. And it's very important to me that there is no such thing. I mean, let's say at least to my eyes at that particular moment of my thought developments, and I might change my ideas as I already did. I don't believe in the existence of anything purely, let's say, purely abstract or purely spiritual beyond the matter of this reality. I think it's always a two aspect thing. It's always you have the heavy stuff, which just, if you just turn it around, or if you just set it in action, and if you just follow the trajectory of what it is doing, if you set matter free, then you inevitably have a feeling aspect or a spiritual aspect. And I mean, this sounds a little bit Whiteheadian, like Whitehead's process philosophy, where he was talking about feeling as let's say as a feature of the most basic particles. And I think we should revisit that as well. And that was one solution to bind together these two aspects of reality. And to my eyes, living beings are just doing this. So in my eyes, in a weird way, the solution to the enigma, wow, how is this possible? How can matter be at the same time the experience of connection? So then you start to study physics, and you start to study quantum physics, and you start to look at this weirdness where you have action at a distance, and you have the strange implication of everything by just one event. But then if you just lean back and breathe in and breathe out, and or you're sitting on a forest floor, and then you realize that as a living being, we already know that matter is feeling, because we are matter, which is feeling. So in a way, it becomes very simple if we just ground our own perception as living beings, that, let's say, that power or the right to make valid observations about reality. I think I have come a little bit away from your question, probably, but maybe that was useful as well.
Yeah, very, very much so. My guest is Andreas Weber. He's the author of Matter and Desire, An Erotic Ecology. Now, you've drawn from a variety, I think, of wisdom traditions. What would you say in terms of the state of religion today, if you could call the different kinds of religion? Are we kind of looking at a religion 2.0 or a spirituality 2.0 with erotic ecology? What I mean, that I'm using kind of a computer metaphor of that we've got all the traditional ones and
nice, but metaphor, a nice metaphor, because I use it as well, only that I say what I do is romanticism 2.0.
Okay.
So we're already very close. And well, I would say actually what I'm trying to do here has always been present. I would say it has always been present, and probably it's closest to the mystical traditions of various religions. And you could also say it's informed biological mysticism in a way. So it's what I'm doing is I'm not dipping in, because I'm not coming from any religious corner. I'm not a Buddhist, and I'm not a Sufi, and I'm not a practicing Christian, but I'm a biologist and nature writer and poet, maybe. That would be the closest, like, let's say, quasi religious description of myself. But I'm trying to, what I'm trying to do in observing bodies and my own body and my own reactions still is very close to the mystical idea, which I already alluded to of the idea that every individual's experience is a reflection of the experience of the whole, which would be the divine whole. I'd say that you could maybe put it like this as a very general definition of the outlook of a mystic position. So in this, what I'm doing is very religious, but on the other hand, the mystics have always been in the minority. They're never the mainstream of their religion. The Sufis are not the mainstream of Islam, and the Christian mystics are not the mainstream of Christianity. And so I have a certain stance on that, but I keep with a minority, but I think it's a minority which has a very accurate intuition about what is going on.
In erotic ecology, it sounds to me, I'm making a connection between theologian Matthew Fox, who talks about the spiritual path of awe, the via, yeah, is in Latin, the via positiva. And you mentioned that, and I hate to go right to the end of the book to talk about this because people might want to wait that as a teaser, but I really appreciated especially that aspect of happiness and laughter. They're talking about laughter as oftentimes thing in response to humor, but you're talking about no laughter itself really as arises as the joy of relationship.
So that's the other aspect of what I'm doing. So I like it that you already asked me, please explain why you're so much talking about death. Uh-huh. Because normally, and now you ask me explain a little bit more why are you so much talking about happiness? So these are the two poles of what I'm doing. And normally I receive, depending on the public or depending on the way of I present my ideas when I give a speech, I receive the one possible skeptical question would be, it's so much about happiness, where's death? And the other one would be, it's so much about death, where's happiness? But as you discovered, so thanks so much for
reading.
Yes,
it's right there, both right there. That's what I like about it. Yeah.
Yes. So that's so important. So I would say that the and you asked this before, what about the basic experience of aliveness? I would say the part of this, the core self experience of I am here as concerned by my own being is always a form of bliss or of happiness. As long as it doesn't go completely wrong, there is a fundamental joy of our own way of being through the connection with others. So it's a kind of, let's say, self-organizing joy, which to my eyes is a way the whole experiences itself as being productive and fertile and desireful through individuals. I would say, and I mean, that's my basic personal stance on that. But I would say that, one thing we know about life is that if it is full life, full aliveness, it is about joy. It is joyful. It is the celebration of connection, or it is the feast of individuality through others. And that's something, to my eyes, that we always receive through other beings, in ecosystems, in the biosphere. So in a traditional way of using the language, you would say this is what we experience in nature. It's the joy of being self in connection, and that's very contagious. That's so contagious that we always want to go there, and we see these shining autumn leaves, or we see the spring blossoms. We will see the spring blossoms next year, and then we'll feel that we are also spring blossoms opening for a connection, and that's joyful. So there's a basic happiness about being a part of this world in connection. And I would say any suffering and any pain, which, as we know, there's a lot of that in this world, it has to do with an obstruction of the joy of being in connection. And so first comes the happiness and then comes pain. But we can't have a world without obstruction, as I tried to explain before, because We need the shrinking to allow for expanding. And then we get into this very interesting, deep, and very, very scarcely understood terrain of the paradox of birth and death again.
I'm speaking with Andreas Weber. We're on Skype from he's from Berlin. We're talking about his book Matter and Desire, an Erotic Ecology. And I want to turn to a sense toward ethics and how an erotic ecology might inspire ethics for, well, let's just say for the issues that we're facing regarding, say, war or our climate change and all of the difficulties that we're facing in terms of caring for Earth.
Yeah. Thanks a lot. That's also very important. And actually, as you probably expect, I'm not offering any traditional ethics in the sense of sets of rules for the behavior of human subjects. Already, I'm not talking about human subjects only anymore. When I'm talking about subjects, it's embodied subjects, starting with cells. And these are agents which are not capable of morals in a maybe platonistic or Kantian sense. So we need something else there. And what I find is a thinking which very much more bases ethics in something you could call ecosystemic thinking, or you could also call it commons ecology. So it's very much about the relationship of one single individual, which needs the remainder of the whole, let's say, ecosystem or system or society to unfold, and which on the other hand needs to contribute to the system in order to sustain the system. And I said commons because we actually had an ethics which was about mutuality, sharing, and which was also about breaking down the barriers between human-only agents and the remainder of the world. And that's a commons ethics. That's something which dominated indigenous worldview probably for the last million years, when, let's say, human societies in the narrow sense started with Homo erectus. And that's something we still find in societies like the Aborigines in Australia, or in societies who live with the land and who sustain the land, and for whom the land and its beings are not different in kind from humans. So there's something which can give us some inspiration, but we're not going to go back to let's say Stone Age ways of relating to the land or to others. But we can learn a lot about breaking down the difference between humans only, and then humans need an ethics, and we need for how to manage the remainder of the world. We don't need an ethics. We just need a technique or a methodology. And to my eyes, we need an ethics which is not about human actors which are above others and which have a moral law and which they need to apply in a brain-only way to manage how to dispose of those who don't have a moral law. So that's the wrong way. And I think we need much more explorations in ethics which are about mutuality, which are about sharing, which are about participating in a bigger whole, which are about the idea of a self is only possible through other. And actually, if I can add this, actually, the ecological idea, which I referred to before, that self deeply needs other in order to connect and to recreate or to create more of self. That's a very profound idea of our experience of loving, because loving is always about blissfully being myself through the existence of you, through the existence of another, through the existence of a you, which grants me the possibility to be myself. And we even have a feeling for this. We even have a feeling for which we call love, although I would say love is the relationship and the feeling is more what we said before, bliss or happiness or lightness or joy. We have a feeling if we are in balance with the remainder of the system. We have a feeling of prosperity and of lightness and of a good sense of floating if we are able to allow ourselves our fundamental needs to connect. And through allowing ourselves these needs, allow also the others the needs to connect. That we strangely we know how it works, and then we feel good. And that's also a set of indicators we humans normally don't really use, because we don't really listen to our emotions in determining our ways. We're listening to what we ought to do or what we need to do or what our boss wants us to do or what our parents told us to do. So we kind of have forgotten that we have an inbuilt sense for ethical balance, which is our feeling of whole or of right or of in a fruitful way to connect. And I think we should tap into this a lot more.
Andreas Weber has been my guest, philosopher, biologist, and writer, and the author of Matter and Desire, An Erotic Ecology, a beautiful and important book. Dr. Weber, thank you so much for this book and for spending time with me today.
Thank you, John.
Progressive Spirit is heard every week. On Progressive Spirit, you hear interviews with cutting-edge scholars, authors, and activists who have something to say about social justice, human flourishing, and the things that matter. Progressive Spirit is formatted for radio and is distributed every week through the Pacifica Radio Network and PRX, the Public Radio Exchange. You can hear Progressive Spirit every week on WETS, Johnson City, Tennessee, WEHC, Emory, Virginia, WPVM, Asheville, North Carolina, Kutztown University Radio, Kutztown, Pennsylvania, KCEI, Taos, New Mexico, KACR, Alameda, California, WDRT, Viroqua, Wisconsin, KSOW, Cottage Grove, Oregon, and KZ88, Kabul, Missouri. You can also catch Progressive Spirit on your favorite podcast app. The website is progressivespirit.net. Follow also on Facebook and Twitter. Progressive Spirit is produced in the studios of KBOO in Portland, Oregon. I'm John Schuck. Be well.